Okay, so here we are on the question and answer session for this Thursday, our postponed call from last week. And so I'm glad to have Carol and Judy and Pat joining us, and others may come in as they will over the next hour. So we were just discussing before we started the recording, because Carol and Judy were expressing an interest in, you know, just how you do market something like this, how you get it going. And I was mentioning that it's really, first of all, the last session in the teleconferences specifically addresses that. However, it's a lot of material, and it's often a new way of doing things for people to work in a collaborative manner. I think one of the things that to me is important is that what we're doing with this work is collaborative with the horses. And so we just need to realize that we need to model that collaboration right from the beginning, the collaboration with other people. Horses help us learn so much about collaboration in their subtle ways of detecting what's going on in a communication, and in their herd wisdom, and what they know about living together. And so we can, it's interesting to actually apply that to the way we handle our lives and the way we take this work forward, that, you know, we have a good idea. And as I was mentioning a few minutes ago, probably one of the major mistakes I hear people making occasionally is that they try to set things up by themselves initially, and then bring other people in after they've got everything set up. And that I've never seen that succeed very well, or succeed at all. In fact, there is always a big course correction that's uncomfortable and can be avoided by initially just getting the word out. Whatever is inspiring you about doing this work or whatever it is, that you have a short, you know, a couple minutes inspiring story about what's inspired you, why you want to do this, and share it with people and start, having a meetings. I usually do it in my home, but sometimes I do it in someone else's home or a public place. Just putting the word out to relevant professionals like horse professionals or, in the case of riding beyond, it would be people involved in breast cancer treatment, breast cancer support groups, anyone I can think of who might be vaguely interested. I just get the word out and say, are you interested? Do you think there's a need for this in our community? They often say, yeah, there is a need for this in our community. Or in some cases, they don't know, But whatever, the people who, part of the importance of having that story that inspires you is that you're not just appealing to people's their head about it, like, do we need this, which is kind of that's kind of a head question. But the story about why you're interested, why you're inspired to do this, that speaks to the heart. And that's what you want is that heart piece when you're bringing people into the work. And so there's, you may be looking for people to actually work for you in professional ways. They should be enlisted right from the beginning, if possible, and volunteers. And, it took me a while to realize when I stepped out of the nonprofit world that people want to volunteer even if you're not a nonprofit. People want to be working around horses, and they love this kind of work. It's, I've never had problems enlisting volunteers because they get inspired. They get enlivened as well, and they want to help out. Of course, most of them want to be hands-on with the horses, but, many of them are not skilled enough to do that. And, you know, if they have opportunities to be around the horse's son, those people will are often happy to help out in less direct ways behind the scenes. And, yeah, so I don't know if so I guess, Judy, what I would say is that you might, after you have actually delved into that fourth session, that has to do with the details of this, then join our call and see what else comes to your mind in terms of asking about that. And anyone else, just now, though, questions about what we were just discussing there, getting started, questions, comments.
I think that helps a lot. It's Carol again. And, you know, I was saying that I live in a very rural area in the middle of Saskatchewan, Canada, and so I don't have a big center to pull from in that way. And also, as we were talking about, you know, the part that's business as such and marketing, and then the other part that's sort of nonprofit, that piece. You know, as you were talking, I was thinking we do have that cancer support group, and they have been out here just for a visit. It's been a couple of years. But I'm going to ask to go to one of their meetings just to do a presentation. That's a good way to start, I think, as you were mentioning, Trish, because I can share it. I can share the benefits and then the challenges, but I also can get their feedback, and that's a great way to really, you know, think about where volunteers come from. So I guess it's that piece of, you know, I have a business, and then I have the you know, it's just always those pieces, but I think that's maybe a good place for me to start. And then, like you say, people are keen to volunteer, so it is building a bit of a. And then this what you're doing here is like a mastermind group for us as well, isn't it? It just really helps us sort these things out.
I guess it is like a mastermind group. I've never actually been in one of those, but yeah, from what I know about them, that is kind of what we're doing here. Although maybe not quite as skillfully as. Or I don't know if any of you have been in a mastermind group. Maybe you might.
Well, I've been in a couple and that are very casual. But all it is really is people interested in a certain topic like this and just sharing with each other, supporting each other with ideas and all of that. Mm-hmm. Right? It's really all that it is. Support
for
like-mindeds.
Yeah, that's definitely what we're doing then.
Yeah.
That's the idea of calling it a mastermind group, yes.
Yeah.
And I found what you said to be very helpful. This is Judy. And you know, it kind of, a light bulb went off with all kinds of ideas because, unlike you, Carol, I live in a much more populated area with all kinds of breast cancer organizations and support groups and facilities. So I'm surrounded by all of this, and I'm kind of centered. I'm a cancer coach, and so I've already approached many organizations about having cancer coaching as part of, you know, the services that they offer. So I do have a nice core group of people, and so this is just another thing that I can add and offer to them. So it's really helpful, and I'll have no problem finding volunteers because there are tons of people out there who would be involved with something like this. I have to find the horses.
Oh, okay. So now, Judy, are you the one who takes people down to North Carolina?
I do, yes. I'm connected with, Women Beyond Cancer.
Yeah. Okay. So, right, we talked.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember that now. Right. Now I'm connecting you to who you are.
There we go.
Yeah. So are you actually interested in bringing, you know, actually doing something with horses on your own then?
Oh, I am. Yes. I am. I have a side business to my coaching called Back in the Saddle Retreats. And I've brought women cancer survivors to Utah and various places where we are around horses. Sometimes we ride, sometimes we don't.
Wow.
I see. So you go, you go to places where, like dude ranches or something where.
Well, we haven't gone to a formal dude ranch where the horses are kind of stabled just to be ridden. The farm that it was a ranch in Utah, and these were Mustangs that we got to ride through through their ranch, which was 20,000 acres. So it was beautiful. Yeah, it was a great experience, and it's more for the horse experience to just be around horses in their environment than to just get on the horse's back and let it take us on the mm-hmm. trail.
That sounds really wonderful.
Sounds
yeah,
nice.
It was a great experience. Four of the women had never been around a horse before, so they took lessons and they learned how to be around horses for 6 months before the trip.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so
I see. Well, that was cool. Smart, and everybody be a little more
yeah.
on the same level. Uh-huh.
And some of the women went down to Aiken and worked with Chris Powers and Julie and learned a lot about being near horses in the non-riding environment beforehand.
Uh-huh.
So,
Aiken is where the
Women Beyond Cancer.
Cancer program is. That
yes.
I think it's interesting to think about how to apply this model that Riding Beyond offers in a
mm-hmm.
situation like that, where you actually take a group to a destination for several days. I think I know that it could be very transformational.
Yes,
it would be similar to seminars and workshops I've done that I call Journey Horse that had a slightly different focus in that they were open to anyone. If they had to do, there was sort of like a journey vision quest, a modern day vision quest. They had a bit of that feel to it. And when we did those, sometimes people brought their own horses. One time in Australia, the whole group brought their own horses, which was really wonderful. And but we held them in places where there were horses available for people who did not have horses. So, and it's frankly, I'd never even thought about doing Riding Beyond in that kind of setting, working with breast cancer survivors. Mm-hmm. So you've given me a new idea, Judy. Thank you.
Oh, well, maybe we'll have to do a group out in Oregon.
Oh, no kidding. That would be great. This is a great place to do it. I'm not exactly sure, where the ranch would be, but I suspect there probably is one.
Uh-huh.
The description.
Or in the middle of nowhere, Saskatchewan. And as you talk, Carol, again, I think, I have three modest cabins that, they have electricity.
You do?
Yeah, and I have, I'm 3.5 hours from Regina, which is the major closest, 3 or 4 hours away from any main. But I do have the land and the cabins, three cabins and that sleep two, people. And and the other thing I'm thinking as you talk, Trish, you were asking if I had any questions. You know what came up for me? And is this a good time to share this or?
Okay.
Did you have anything else on your agenda for the moment?
Well, we do have. Well, we have two items on the agenda. One is to talk about the imaginal body. When Perio from Belgium asked if we would discuss that a bit, and Pat, did you want to talk some more? Want us to talk some more about Egala?
No, I'm good. I'd like to hear about. I mean, if you want to.
No, I'm
here to learn.
We had that conversation the other day, so we may not need to talk about Egala, or I could just say a word or two. But So those are the only two things that people requested ahead of time. And so go ahead, Carol. We've got time.
Well, this is just something that came up to me, after our last call, and I thought to myself, first of all, touch wood. I haven't had an experience of cancer myself, so part of me was saying, "Well, what are you doing? Like getting involved with this? You don't even know. It's not like I don't know people, or have lost people and have had cancer. So that kind of gripped me for a bit. And then there was also this bit of fear, you know, the fear of even getting into this because, you know, I mean, a cancer is a scary thing whether you have it or don't or know people. So those are the two things that sort of came up for me. And I just wondered for yourself and others, maybe if you could touch on that a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, you know, well, the first thing you talked about that you haven't had cancer, that was part of my own personal searching in the first few months after I was inspired to do the program. And I came back home from the conference where I'd heard about something similar to it, to what I'm doing now. And, you know, I had to do some soul searching. Like, in fact, as I was gathering volunteers in those first few months, there was one woman in particular who stepped forward to volunteer, and she was a breast cancer survivor, like several others, and she was a horse person as well. And after, I can't remember at what point, but she emailed me, and she said that she felt like the program should be conducted only by breast cancer survivors, and that since I wasn't a survivor, that she didn't feel it was appropriate for me to be doing this, and that she was going to step down. And that really shocked me, because I liked her, you know, and I was disappointed that, I mean, she wasn't like a close friend or anything, but she was someone I'd been acquainted with for a few years. And so that really got me to questioning that. And I actually talked to other cancer survivors about it who were in our group. And I just did some personal soul searching. And I realized that part of a major reason for me personally to be wanting to do this was that two very close friends had gone through stage 4 breast cancer treatment. And they both have passed away since then. But I accompanied one of them especially. I even went up to Seattle for a few weeks to live with her, to accompany her in treatment and to help her get established with a circle of support up there. And then another friend was here locally, and she was actually a physician who had stage 4 breast cancer. She survived about 10 years, and it actually completely, she was never completely cancer-free during those 10 years, but she completely changed her medical practice so that she was a consultant to cancer people who were trying to find ways to integrate. This was, you know, like 15 years ago when this was not done so much. Now it is, but she was helping people find alternative treatments to enhance their medical treatment. So she was one of the pioneers. Many doctors now do that in treating cancer. But when she started it, she was out there trying, you know, kind of out there on the edge, bringing in these treatments. And so anyway, the point is I was intimately involved with both of them in their journey during those years. And I felt a lot of compassion for them. And I realized that I wanted to offer that to other women, that I wanted to reach out to them. I never even thought about my horses being helpful to those two friends at the time, although the one friend did come out and ride once when she came down to Ashland. But it never occurred to me that it could be a healing mode for either one of them. It just wasn't in my mind. And so, you know, I think everyone's, you know, got to work that out for themselves. You know, it's
helpful to hear that. It's helpful to understand your journey.
Yeah.
Can I speak to that?
Sure.
As a breast cancer survivor myself, and a cancer coach now because of that, in my cancer coach training, and we had two women who were our trainers. One is a 5-time cancer survivor, and the other was her life coach as she went through it, was not a survivor. And both were equally helpful because breast cancer is not a disease that affects just the person who has cancer. It's everybody. It's their family. It's their friends. It's much bigger than just the patient. And so everybody's touched by it dramatically. Sometimes the caregivers have a harder time than the patient has going through it.
Indeed.
And so you don't have to have had the physical experience of breast cancer to have gained the compassion and everything else that goes along with it. So I'm sorry that one woman didn't get that because it's a shame.
As I talk to other people, you know, like one friend, she put it in a nutshell. She said, well, that's like saying that a doctor can't be a good doctor if he hasn't had all the diseases that...
Yeah.
Right.
Look
at all the men gynecologists out there.
Yeah, right. And it was just like, well, that really puts it in a nutshell, you know.
That's helpful, yes.
Yeah, and so, you know, I've worked out that piece of it. And so let me speak to that issue of fear of cancer, because that's one of the things we do talk about in the teleconferences, that this work does bring up your mortality, and it does for the volunteers, it does for me and everyone. It puts you face to face with your mortality, and that brings up fear. And so it's a journey that, I don't bring it up, I guess I would say, in Writing Beyond, but it comes up. It comes up, and then we talk about it, okay, when it comes up. And you know, I remember one day this spring where it was really in our face. There had been several deaths in the friendship circles of those just happened to be there that day. And I believe a horse had died on the property as well a few days before. So it was like, it was just in the air. We needed to talk about it. And so we did. You know, it was a circle of women just being honest about how hard this was. And so, Judy, I'd be interested in knowing what your coach training tells you about handling those kinds of...
About fear? When dealing with somebody who has panic and fear... The worst thing somebody can do is hide from it, run away from it, and ignore it, because it stays there. It doesn't go away just because you're trying to distract yourself from it. And the way to get beyond fear is to go into it and look at it and feel the feelings. Like, allow yourself to let it come out and experience the physical feelings and any thoughts and emotion that come up, and embrace it. Just allow yourself to be in it. And that's how you get through it. And it's like, oh, okay. All right, I have control over this.
I would say what you're saying is true, not only for working with our clients, but for ourselves as well.
Absolutely.
This work brings up our own personal issues. You know, for instance, last summer, we were having extreme heat and smoke here starting in early August. We had 6 weeks. I've never experienced anything like it. And it started affecting my health. After 10 days, I became like allergic to the smoke. I had to wear a mask to go outside.
What's the smoke?
It's from forest fires.
Oh, wow, it spreads. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the smoke somehow was funneled both from California and other parts of Oregon, so from the south and the north, was somehow funneled into our community, our valley, which I think we set some kind of record, because it was nauseating, and it was a big health issue for lots and lots of people. I mean, we literally couldn't see across the street sometimes. It was like thick fog. And, you know, we'd have, it would clear up for maybe an hour every few days. And you know, you normally would think, oh, boy, it's over. And a couple hours later, it would just pour right back in. And so anyway, it affected me where I was having a lot of sinus issues. I started having extreme fatigue. I didn't want to go outside. Even just to go out to empty the garbage, I had to put on a mask. So I didn't go out much with my horses. I finally just went and hauled them over to the coast twice because the coastal air was clear. And I felt great when I was on there, but then I'd have to come back home. And so I started, you know, experiencing this sort of subtle survival dread. You know, I felt like my very health, that I was really being challenged. And I realized that this is what breast cancer survivors feel, you know, and that it was probably heightened in me because of my working with breast cancer survivors. And, you know, so, you know, I had a lot of personal work to do during that time that had to do with my own fear of, you know, like, was I putting myself, I even wondered at times, am I getting cancer? You know, like, what is going on? Because it was so odd to me that I was having such a extreme reaction. But on the other hand, I'd never been around that kind of smoke for that long a time. You know, it took about 10 days before I started reacting. And so, you know, I think it comes up for us to deal with, to attend to. You know, I see that my own personal process, I guess I would say, is what I give to myself in terms of allowing myself to be alchemized by this. You know, to go into it, as you say, Judy, yes, and to know that is what's going to happen with this kind of work when you take it on. It, but you know, hey, that's what life is. That's what life is.
And the first part of our training is to get in touch with our own feelings about death and dying, because the best way to work with somebody who's going through that is to have thought it through yourself, because I was much more afraid of it before when I didn't explore it. And now that I've explored what that really means to me on a spiritual level, I'm much less afraid of it.
And I would say that that's true for me as well. Although it still comes up in different, it comes up in different ways for me to attend to again. And I, you know, I guess I need to say that during the first year that I was actually before we started our first full year of Writing Beyond, I had a really pretty traumatic experience myself, where my daughter and her two children and my ex-husband suddenly landed on my doorstep for a, quote, visit, and they ended up staying, my daughter and her two children stayed for 2 years.
That was quite a visit.
And I just live in a, you know, I live in a two-bedroom house, like 1,000 square feet. So it was pretty intense. But the thing that was traumatic about it was that my ex-husband and I were friends, but from a distance, I guess I'd say, because we were friends, especially over our children. You know, we stayed in touch about them. And so, him coming to live with me gave us this sort of new, we'd been divorced about 10 years, I guess. And so here he was living with me, and we were attending to our daughter and her two children, because she was, essentially her marriage was coming apart. And so we were becoming closer friends, is what I would say. We were having a wonderful time. And then, so finally, one day in December, I said, you know, it looks like you guys are going to be here a while. I think in the next, during the holidays, we ought to sit down and just assume that you're going to be here a while. It's not just going to be for another couple of weeks. And make a plan for the coming year. And he agreed. And so did my daughter. And then that night, he died completely unexpectedly. He died in his sleep. And it was such a blow.
It oh, my gosh.
A huge. It was just like, it was just huge. And you know, I still feel haunted to a certain extent. I mean, I'm haunted is maybe too strong a word, but, you know, the presence of death was just shocking and so real that I felt it as a real presence in my life for a long time. And I guess I still do. But most, I would say most people probably don't have that kind of a shocking inner, you know. And so this was when I was just, you know, this was in December, and we had just completed in September the pilot program for Writing Beyond. And so we were going into our first full year of programming. So it was, you know, it was a piece that was with me, and it has been since then. It's not nearly so acute, but it certainly made me very aware of death in a way that I hadn't been. I just hadn't had I've never had a sudden loss like that. And part of what made it so stressful was that my daughter was under so much stress that I had no idea how I was going to help her without his presence, because he brought this extremely valuable piece of being able to carry on conversations that were helpful. And without him there, it was tough. Really tough, because so my daughter was not only dealing with the breakup of her marriage, but also, you know, mourning her father's passing, and so that was very hard for us all to negotiate that with her right here in my house, and but the gift of that, like Judy was saying, the gift of that was that I got to get up close and personal with the loss that it brings, that it brought to me. And then,
yeah, a loss, but I'm also hearing that there is beauty in the relationship between you and your ex-husband, that there was this beautiful closure that you didn't have had you not experienced that.
Totally. I was so appreciative of that, you know. And, you know, part of me was appreciative. The other part was like, well, wait a minute. I was expecting a little more. Especially in relationship to our daughter. You know,
yeah.
I felt
but you didn't finish. You didn't stay long enough to finish.
Yeah, right. We had a little more, I thought, that we needed to do together. But, right.
Well.
And I think life is so much often, it's so often that way. It's bittersweet. It's bitter and sweet. Mm. All at the same time, when we attend to it with the heart, you know, from the perspective of unconditional love, and so
thanks
others. Anyone else have thoughts about that?
Thanks for sharing that story.
Yeah,
Trish, thanks. That was amazing.
Yeah. Anyone else's thoughts on that? Maybe that's all we need to say. I think it's important not only when it comes up for us individually. I wouldn't necessarily bring it up with a client, because that's not professionally appropriate at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I think to be candid with volunteers, the people you're working with, you know, if because that's what actually catalyzed this really beautiful conversation that I mentioned last spring, when it suddenly was just so present, because we were all sharing. We're sharing our lives. We don't set them at the door when we come into Writing Beyond, you know, like it's often recommended. in the workplace, for instance, like leave your personal life at the door and then come in and work. We don't recommend that. But I mean, the focus is on the client during our sessions, but we make sure that we have time before and after to connect with the volunteers and what's going on in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So, and so I think that's important. You know, just in the way we conduct things, to be honest and open, but in a way that doesn't make the sessions about us, but it's still about the client, you know. And
mm-hmm.
And it's a big piece of volunteer training also, that's different to therapeutic writing, to be cognizant of this issue and make it a part of your volunteer training. We talked about that in the teleconferences. And, yeah. So we're always kind of tweaking our volunteer training as we learn more about this and adding things to it. And that's one piece that we added pretty in the first year. We added it, but hadn't included that bit initially, that it was going to bring up our own mortality. And so let's just sit with that for just a moment. Kind of receive the receive that. And I feel like it might be good to, I would like to just talk for a moment. Pirjo from Belgium asked me to talk a little more about the imaginal body, that she felt that she wasn't real clear about that in the teleconference. However, she did write me yesterday that she'd gotten farther in my book and had read the chapter about imaginal body. She felt that that was a lot more informative, gave her a lot more information. And so if you're interested in the imaginal body, it is developed more in my book, if you haven't already read that. But one of the things I wanted to talk about the imaginal body is that I don't really go into so much there in my book. But, I mean, so just to review what that is that when we develop our imagination at a level that we often have compromised in our modern world by, you know, being the receptor of movies and so much, that we become passive in terms of our imaginations. But if we instead sort of reclaim the power of what we can do with our imagination and really take it into the muscular imagination of our bodies, and that really opens to us a lot of capacities for our brain-mind systems, and it actually opens us to other worlds beyond our brain-mind system. And I've just been... For the past week, I attended an 8-day seminar by Jean Houston, who I've studied with for many years, but I actually hadn't been to an event of hers for 5 or 6 years. So this was just wonderful, in-depth study of what it means to be a social artist. And, 8 days. It was amazing. She brought in Dwayne Elgin and other people, too. But one of the things that she was talking about, one of the themes was what she calls emergence, and Dwayne Elgin calls it that too. I don't know if you know Dwayne Elgin, but he was pretty well known years ago as the writer of Voluntary Simplicity back in the 60s, I think, or 70s maybe. which had to do with living a simple lifestyle in response to the global situation, global values. And in the 70s, he was also involved in psychic research with the government, where they explored psychokinesis, in other words, and remote viewing. So remote viewing is being able to psychically know what someone else is thinking about or seeing. And psychokinesis has to do with using your mind to move something that's in another location. And one of the stories he told, for instance, was that with the early psychokinesis, they'd set up one of these clocks that I remember them. They like have kind of a rotating mechanism that rotates back and forth. That's like four kind of balls suspended, and it's inside of a glass bell jar. Okay, have you seen those kind of clocks? I haven't seen one for years, but they used to be fairly popular or available from Germany in particular, I remember. And so anyway, the experiment was that it was this clock mechanism was completely enshrouded in all kinds of protective things, and then a person was asked to try to influence this mechanism, and they had it wired up so that that they could measure it, what was going on inside all the protection. You know, they had sensors, okay? And so the idea was just for them to get this mechanism to move at all, okay? It was just sitting there static. And as long as the person, what they found was as long as the person was, like, mentally trying to influence it, there was no effect at all. As long as they were trying to do strong willpower and strong intention, nothing happened at all. So this one guy switched gears and he went into meditation. And he just, and what he did was in his mind was he just melded with the clock mechanism. He just like communicated with it, and it started vibrating to the point where it actually broke the glass bell jar around the that it was being held in. And they were able to replicate this many times. And when he was telling that story, it made me really think of working with horses, that, you know, you can stand out there and try to do power over the horse. And, you know, they may become obedient, but you often aren't going to get the results you want when you're taking a power over approach to a horse, like, this is what I want you to do and do it, you know. But it's when you take that a different attitude of partnering with a horse and communicating with a horse, that there's a kind of synergy back and forth between the horse and the human, that things start happening. You know, the horse becomes more interested. The horse in willing, they start initiating interactions. There's this heart connection that happens. It's not just about obedience and performance. And so it was really interesting. So to get back to the imaginal body, part of what they were discussing was that there is this process of emergence that we can all participate in, and that in fact, the way he sees it is that it's a scientifically proven fact through quantum physics and other things, that we are actually living in an emerging universe, a living universe that's emerging all the time. And in fact, it's constantly going on and off all the time, which is a little hard for me to get my mind around. But the way they talked about it, the metaphor they used, has to do with the word imaginal, because it's really much like the caterpillar who goes about engorging itself, and then it creates that cocoon and it moves into this. It basically dissolves. The caterpillar inside becomes this mush, and the thing that it's even called this in biology is that on the outer layer of the of that interior mush, there are what they call imaginal cells. And these imaginal cells, at some point in this process, they start activating. These imaginal cells start activating. And they actually start configuring the mush that has been the cocoon or the caterpillar into a butterfly, so that eventually these imaginal cells have all the information needed for that mush to reconfigure itself into a butterfly, which emerges at some point. And so in our work with the imaginal body, as we talk about it in developing our imagination, like imagining our higher self, getting into the sensibility of animals, and all kinds of ways that we might work with our own imaginal bodies. That in fact, what we are doing is that same process in the same way that the imaginal cells reconfigure the mush in the cocoon. We have that possibility with our imaginal bodies to reconfigure, you might say, our lives, to allow us to emerge to a new step in our own personal evolution. And in many ways, that's what we're asking these women to do. I talked about it as they're having the opportunity to be alchemized by this this experience of breast cancer, which is kind of like going into the mush stage of the caterpillar, that, you know, their lives as they had known them are no longer present, you know, and they have the possibility of, by working with their imaginal body and other things as well, to emerge changed and alchemized into another higher stage of evolution, you might say. And one of the things we talked about last week was the difference between redemptive healing and evolutionary healing. I'd never thought of this difference before. I found it quite interesting. Redemptive healing is really what Western medicine is based on, and in a lot of our Western ways. It has to do with when there's something wrong with us, we're ill, we have an injury or whatever, we want to fix it. We want to bring things back to normal, so to speak, and there's a quality of redemption about that, of, you know, bringing things back to the way they used to be, or, you know, to repair it, to repair. And you contrast that with evolutionary healing, which has a different sense. It has to do more with that, with the attending to our woundings. We have the opportunity to sort of spiral up in our own personal stages of evolution, you know, that we can come to a higher place, a higher step in our own growth through these challenges. You see the difference? Mm-hmm. You get what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I realized, you know, I operate with both of those. I hadn't thought of the difference. I hadn't noticed the difference, but now I'm real aware of it. When we talk about the hero's journey, for instance, in the teleconference, that's a spiraling, ascending pattern that we go through in our lives. We experience ourselves being in an outmoded way of being, and we take on the challenge of going into another realm of amplified being and taking on new challenges and, you know, gaining some boon, and then we bring that back to our day-to-day life. And the sense is that there's a kind of ascending spiral to it all as we go through those cycles throughout our lives. And that we can, look at, for instance, Dwayne Elgin he said since the 1970s he's been a media activist, which means that he feels that so much of movies and TV, just, you know, they're full of violence that sort of quash that understanding of life as being evolutionary. You see, that it's based on, you know, good and bad and destroying the bad and getting the good back in power. And he feels that it's missing the possibility of like our whole planetary healing that's needed, that media is so powerful that it's actually perpetuating the problem in the way that it hasn't seen the higher pattern of what's going on in the universe, this emergence quality, that it's the media has a huge, powerful role that they haven't really claimed. They haven't claimed, and he's all about. He's been doing all kinds of things to try to shift that. I suspect he probably doesn't feel too successful about it at this point. But you know, but again, those images that in the media, they're feeding our imaginal world. Okay, and we have a choice to make about how we want to populate our imaginal world, what's inside, what we carry around with us, the stories that we tell ourselves, the way we live. And so that's part of what we attend to in Writing Beyond, is working with the imaginal body and recognizing the power of it, for healing. You know, how it feels like miraculous when you start understanding how powerful the imaginal body and the imaginal world can be. So, some of your thoughts about this? We have a few more minutes, about 5 more minutes.
Trish, I think it's fascinating, and I can see it at work in many different situations in my past, and just delving deeper into it and be able to see it more or pick it up more.
Mm-hmm.
I seem to be able to do it with my horses. It's magical, but it's just hard to explain.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's hard to talk about it. One of the things I appreciated about these 8 days was that that's what we were talking about. But still, bringing it into the day-to-day world with our horses is a next step, another challenge.
Right.
And can I ask how you do that? Using the horses to bring out the imaginational body?
Well, Pat, do you want to speak to that, or shall I speak to that?
You give it a start, and I'm going to. It's
okay.
Really hard for me. It's really magic. It's
oh, Carol, gosh. I have one word for it, or a few words. It's about all the non-horsey things that we experience in this work, isn't it? Amaze and astound and deepen. I find it so much about letting go of the mind and allowing, and that takes practice as well.
Is this just being in the presence of the horse? It just happens? Or is it something that you talk about with your client first? Or just by being around them, they'll just get the experience?
Being around them and picking up how you're feeling, just go into it. It's almost like you were talking about accepting fear.
Uh-huh.
Accept your presence with the animal. they're going to approach this. They're new. They've been around the horse. There's this huge barrier of fear. But if you just go into it and just be there, there's a connection. I need to learn how to, with Trisha's help, explain that. I grew up on a 1,200-acre working cattle ranch. I was around horses forever, and after a while, you pick up this thing where, now with my horse, you just go and you have an agenda, and the horse picks up that agenda. There is no teaching or training, or you just do, and it's a connection you make automatically. And so with the people, our clients, you know, I don't know. I need help in explaining this, really, to get it across. I have this, and I needed to get it across to my clients.
So the way I think about it and work with it is that I'm after enabling people to have a sense that they have a horse accompanying them in their imagination, that there is literally a horse at their side, if they choose to call on it. And so there's a lot of ways of developing that. Now, through the imaginal body piece really directly, for instance, when they first are greeting the horse in the first session, and then they go, and I encourage them to just touch the horse. You know, and so some people do that pretty tentatively, and if they're not able to, like, put their hand, like, fully on the horse's body, then I usually have them groom the horse first, okay, as a way to ease into that contact. But what I'm going for eventually is for them to lay their hands on the horse's back, for instance, you know, and to feel into that musculature of the horse's back, and to literally think about their imaginal hands, like, you know, like, say that their hands can sink through that horse's skin into the muscles and feel deeply into the horse's body. Now, one of the ways I teach this, too, is in a longer workshop is I teach the Linda Tellington Jones T-Touch. Are you all familiar with the T-Touch?
Yes, I love her.
Yeah, well, if you haven't, you can look into it. But the way I teach it is pretty much the way Linda teaches it, you know, in terms of laying the hand, anchoring with the thumb, and then making a circle with the three fingers without sliding on the skin, just making that circle and just moving that around. And so, but what I do beforehand is I'll have them do it on another person. Okay, they'll practice on another person in the workshop, on someone's shoulder or their arm. And then I'll have them just think about having that their fingers are longer, and that they're just to imagine that their fingers are longer and reaching down into that person's muscles more deeply so that they can effect a deeper sense of this relief that they're asking the muscle to do. And invariably, the person who is receiving that practice feels the difference. They feel it. They notice the difference when that imaginal practice comes into play. And so then when they practice that on the horse, they can start to see the horse responding to the touch. They'll relax. They'll feel it. Their eyes will soften. Their ears will relax as that person touches them more deeply, okay? And so that is helping with that connection that Pat's talking about, because the person starts feeling connected to the horse in a much deeper way than they had previously. Okay? So it's very precise in a way to teach, use this to the imaginal body work to catalyze that connection. And when they experience that connection, it's like a heart-opening experience. There's often tears, you know, and they carry that experience with them for the rest of their lives, you see. And then another way I address it is by telling stories. Sometimes I tell classical stories about, like, Chiron, for instance, or, you know, the horse-human relationship. But we often, we encourage, for instance, in our first session, we ask for people when they're getting acquainted, instead of just saying, who are you and why are you here? Instead, I say, when was a time in your life when you knew in your heart you were on the right track? So that elicits stories that have to do with their being connected with that place in their heart, okay? Because we're going towards, what we're going for is a heart-to-heart connection with a horse, okay? So they're telling that story about their own heart, wisdom, knowing at some time in their life, prepares them for that imaginal event to happen with a horse a few minutes later, okay? So those are some of the ways that the imaginal body is developed. I mean, those are just a few. There's, you know, another, I do this long process, it's like 45 minutes, where we go back in the history of the horse, back in time, 40,000 years, with music accompanying it, and we're walking backwards in the arena or something. And then we walk forward and offering the gifts of the horse to the human community, to the world, to the planet. And it's developing that imaginal sense of how we are at a place in history, you know, that we've been together with horses for 40,000 years, and what that's meant to the human journey. I have little, you know, excerpts about what that's looked like, and then what it can mean for the future, for our personal future, and for the future of the world. So that's another way of using the imaginal body to anchor these kinds of things. Does that help?
Yes, very much. Thank
you.
Yes,
that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a little after 2, so I'm going to call a close to our call today. Now, next month, in the 1st of September, I think it is September 1st is our next call, and so I will look forward to being with you then. I'm going to be heading out of town a couple of days after that to go to Bali, but I will look forward to, in my packing frenzy on that day, to be talking with you all. And I'm hoping that Jen might be able to join us that day too. She's quite ill today with a bad cold, so she wasn't able to join us, but hopefully she can join us in September. And so thank you all for being with us.
Thank you.